Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies, Latin American Studies, titled Manufacturing Authenticity, the Idea of Mexican Food in Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless. Our speaker is Ignacio Sanchez Prado, Jarvis Thurston and Mona Van Duen Professor in the Humanities at Washington University in St. Louis. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Professor Adela Pineda Franco, Director of Latin American Studies at Boston University.
I have the pleasure to introduce Ignacio Sanchez Prado, who is the Jarvis Thurston and Mona Van Duen Professor in the Humanities, very long title, at Washington University in San Luis. Professor Sanchez Prado has an impressive body of publications, books, edited volumes, articles, and if I were to enlist all of them, we would not have time to listen to him tonight. Just let me say that at a moment when U.S.-Mexico relations are the object of unremitting and not always discerning attention, Professor Sanchez Prado's scholarship brings a fresh and powerful approach to the study of Mexico and its culture here in this country. He is well known for his studies on intellectual thought. Here I recall books such as Naciones Intelectuales, Las Fundaciones de la Modernidad Literaria Mexicana, also on how continental theory travels across borders, from north to south and south to north. I think on his study on Pierre Bourdieu in Hispanic Literature and Culture, also on his recent edited volume, Mexican Literature in Theory. His books and edited volumes explore also major currents in literary and cultural thought. Orientalism, cosmopolitanism, world literature are some of these topics that have Mexico at its center, or Latin America as well. He's very well known in the field of cinematic studies, or cinema studies, due to his unprecedented study on neoliberalism and Mexican cinema. He's also an insightful critic of the everyday and of popular culture. Nacho, as we all know him, is a mentor and above all, a major leader in the field of Mexican studies today. The title of his talk is Manufacturing Authenticity, the Idea of Mexican Food in Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless. So let's give him a big applause.
Okay, thank you for being here. This is a topic that I just started researching 2 years ago. It's the kinds of things that you can do once you are full professor and you don't have to respond to committees. And those who know me know that I'm a very big enthusiast of food. So now that I cannot eat it because I turned 40, I now research it. But this is actually going to be published in a longer version as an article in the Bulletin of Spanish Studies within the year. And I think that I always say that I work, that my fuel is frustration. And the idea of authentic Mexican food is one that really frustrates me. Not because I don't understand the gesture, but authenticity—the idea of authenticity—is contrary to the way food actually works, right? Food is transcultural. Food is travels. Migrant communities bring it. The communities negotiate it. Whenever you talk about authentic Mexican food, and this I know I'm a contrarian, but it's a thing to think about. I think we're disparaging Mexican Americans. Right? Like being Mexican from Mexico has some kind of inherent superior cultural superiority than being a Mexican from the United States. We disparage working class entrepreneurs that are trying to make a living in a country that is not hospitable to them. So I have been working on that particular line in this particular article. Another thing to say before I start is that the field of food studies in the humanities is booming right now. There's universities that have well-established programs, and it's a way to connect the humanities to social sciences, natural sciences, business schools, and the like. So I think that the field is going to be growing soon, but it's not very big in Hispanic studies yet. It's starting to show. The dossier and bulletin of Spanish studies is done by two colleagues, Lara Anderson and Rebecca Ingram, and they work from Spain, the perspective of Spain, and they're starting to develop research in that area. There's another volume called Gastronarratives that is coming to the University of Arkansas Press next year. I contributed a text on Salvador Novo's History of Mexican Cuisine. So it's developing. But I think that one of the questions is that the methodological tools of this still have to be discussed. The published version of this has a good 10 pages about that. I'm not going to read them today because it's really dry. So I'm just going to talk about the fun part, which is Rick Bayless and Diana Kennedy. And I'll be happy to listen to questions since this is emerging research for me. The next book that I'm writing on the subject is going to be about the idea of the taco, right? So maybe I'll come in 2 years with that idea to Boston and present it here. And for those of you who haven't seen announcements, I'm going to be in Tufts University tomorrow speaking about a book that I'm completing this year, but that one is the follow-up to my book on neoliberalism. And it's called The Transnational Film Paradox. It's on global Mexican cinema, and it is against transnationalism in cinema. So, you know, I hate Coco, I hate Spectre, and it's the book where I channel that hate in particular. So we'll, but that's tomorrow's chat. So, food aficionados passing through the American Airlines terminal at the Chicago O'Hare International Airport. Note that an essential destination can be found across Gate K4. This is the location of 103 Tortas Frontera, Rick Bayless' famous Mexican street food restaurant. Amid the many national fast food chains that populate airport terminals, Tortas Frontera brings a version of Mexico's iconic street sandwich to travelers that otherwise may end up consuming the serialized meals of McDonald's, Manchu Wok, or Chili's. Tortas Frontera also provides a performance of authenticity to its patrons. There are aguas frescas that rotate in coolers similar to the ones found in Mexican taquerias, and recognizable sandwich fillings like milanesa, choriqueso, and even the torta cubana, reminiscent of the corner tortería in Mexico City. Yet, a minimally close look at the menu shows that, delicious as this food undoubtedly is, it is also quite a departure from Mexico City's food establishments. Instead of the griddle round steak of the original, the pepito is filled with beef short rib and wild arugula, an herb that one rarely finds in Mexican cuisine. While meatball sandwiches are a staple of Italian cuisine and very good, it would be nearly impossible to find a torta de albóndigas in a Mexican establishment. The toppings available in the guacamole bar that is down there, so the middle is the pepito, are inspired additions. Sun-dried tomatoes, pepitas, bacon, but not part of guacamoles in Mexico. The fact that Rick Bayless, a white Anglo-Saxon guy from Oklahoma, has been able to construct a veritable empire selling authentic Mexican food is a cultural phenomenon that requires more scholarly attention than it would seem. Bayless owns a network of restaurants, including the flagship Frontera Grill, the upscale Topolobampo, the street style Choco, the casual concept Fonda Frontera, although that actually just closed, Frontera Tortas, and more recently, the Baja California Spar Línea Brava and the brewery's Cerveceria Cruz Blanca, everything is in Chicago. As well as a grocery store brand that you probably have seen that brings products like tortilla chips, salsas, and roasted tomatoes to home cooks everywhere. He sold that brand to Cargill for $80 million, so that gives you a sense of the size of the business. He also has a significant media presence. If you have PBS, you can see his show Mexico One Plate at the Time, which I actually really recommend. It's in its 12th season now, and he has 8 cookbooks spanning from authentic Mexican to more Mexican every day, from 1987 to 2015. All of the different practices and debates that surround Bayless's notion of the Mexican food are underpinned by the deployment of performance of the idea of authenticity and the implied claim that the food that does not perform the set criteria is therefore fake, inauthentic, or not real. Like when people say it's not real Mexican food. Yet the significant gaps of meaning and performance that exist between Bayless's products, dishes, groceries, recipes, and their counterparts in Mexico provide a patent sense that authenticity is not so much a category of identity as such, but to use Pierre Bourdieu's terminology, a habitus, but in the sense of embodied behavior and of a relational structure to fields of production and power, which also generates legitimacy and distinction. Thusly, the understanding of how authenticity is constructed and performed and the concrete structures of symbolic capital and value it creates provides a pathway to account for the economic, political, and cultural processes that underlie a figure like Bayless. In the following minutes, I intend to analyze the way this purported authenticity is narrated and performed, and the nature of the symbolic capital that emerges from it. Although my analysis will partly focus on Bayless, I spend also time discussing the work of his most important precursor, Diana Kennedy. A British expat in Mexico, she's 96 years old this year, whose cookbooks formulated the idea of authentic Mexican food as it is understood in the English-speaking world. Kennedy's books, starting with her landmark The Cuisines of Mexico from 1972, changed the very definition of Mexican food based on the practice of learned amateurship. And she's one thing that I want to make clear is that I'm going to be critical, but I don't hate them at all. I actually respect them and admire both of them very much. Diana Kennedy has been instrumental in saving entire regions of traditions of Mexican cuisine. And she just donated, if you're an interested in pursuing the research, I'm still salivating myself, a collection of 1,600 original historical cookbooks that she gathered all over her life to the University of Texas in San Antonio, where they're going to be available for researchers, and it's going to be the most complete collection of cookbooks. And it also has her notes and her diaries from all the time that she has done this work. She actually lives in Michoacán, so. Both Kennedy and Bayless are able to construct authenticity in part due to the fact that they only participate in Mexican culinary nationalism at a distance, informed by it, but not committed to projects of state building or identity development. Sorry. And also because the respective authority in the field of gastronomical culture allows them to challenge the limits of both immigrant food traditions in the United States and understandings of gastronomical culture informed by cultural coloniality in Mexico. Food occupies a peculiar place in the construction of social distinction, because as Pierre Bourdieu notes, the art of eating and drinking remains one of the few areas in which the working classes explicitly challenge the legitimate art of living. In Bourdieu's telling, the ethic of convivial indulgence allows people to participate in structures of enjoyment that do not always clearly identify with class. One can certainly add that although celebrity chefs like Bayless may in fact claim a central role in the performance of authenticity, the savoir-faire of lower-class cooks and restaurateurs from ethnic and economic minorities has an aura of distinction that someone like Bayless can never reach. The concept of authenticity informs these complex logics of distinction as it provides the quilting point that structures the ideological discourse of Mexicanness performed by Kennedy or by Bayless. It structures and gives sense to an ideology of Mexicanness that allows for the social experience and practice of Mexican cultural signifiers, from food products to crafts to media, a self-evident knowledge, but always with significant gaps from Mexican culture as actually practiced in the ground. And here Mexican culture means both from Mexico and Mexican culture by the Mexican, American, and Chicano communities and the expatriate communities in other places. I think that a very important thing that we have to start doing in Mexican studies is that Mexican culture is not, or Mexican students do not study people living in Mexico. Obviously, the community is much larger than that. It is precisely because of the self-evidence of the idea of authenticity that quilts and renders meaningful meanings of the entirety of cultural signifiers that Bayless is able to create enterprises that are just defined as Mexican. Practices as such by consumers in opposition to the inauthentic offerings of brands like Tostitos, Taco Bell, and Old El Paso. One quick anecdote that is actually a fun anecdote. If you go to Norway, Norwegians have Taco Friday because Old El Paso spend an enormous amount of marketing money. So they're all over the supermarkets there, and the Norwegians buy it on Fridays, which is apparently the worst day to buy fish. And they buy beef, and they use it to cook with their children. So it's a whole thing. And to counter that, there's a Mexican-American chef from Chicago who trained in NOMA. Her name is Rosie Sanchez. And she actually opened a taco stand in the market of Copenhagen to show the Scandinavians what an authentic Mexican taco is. So there's a lot of these. I have anecdotes like that, like a ton that I've been collecting for many years. As a concept of cultural theory, but part of the example is Rosie Sanchez, who's Mexican-American. She's in the Ugly Delicious episode in Netflix, where they do the tacos, and she actually complains that when she goes to Mexico, they don't treat her like Mexican. But in Denmark, he's the purveyor of authentic Mexicanness. So relationality and positionality are a thing here, right? As a concept of cultural theory, authenticity has a very peculiar trajectory that traces back to the field of folklore studies. As Regina Bendix argues, the search of authenticity is fundamentally an emotional and moral quest, and folklore has long served as a vehicle in the search for the authentic, satisfying a longing for escape from modernity. Authenticity, though, is also tied for the ways in which this longing becomes either mobilized for political as well as its gradual transformations into experiences of capital that are thoroughly modern, but nonetheless presented as original. The binaries used to define the authentic versus the inauthentic have become destabilized, and a constructivist approach has emerged in which authenticity is a product of cultural processes, individual experiences, and the manufacturing of tourism industries. Just think about, for example, the politics, who is really an American, right? How it unfolds upon race, upon class, upon politics, and that's more or less the same thing that is happening here. What emerges from this discussion is that the ideology of authenticity is not so much about the performance of millennial historical culture, or even about the symbolic link with some sort of primordial originality. There's a Twitter guy called Juanpa on Twitter, and somebody told him that what he was seeing was not authentic, and he replied, my grandmother is a tamal. So, you know, you can really shoot down those kinds of things, right? So this primordial originality actually has a history, all of these things about authenticity that we have. We also have it in hipster culture, for example. It's the idea developed in existentialism. So the part that I'm not reading, you has a lot of Heidegger like running through it, but I'm saving that one. Later elaborated by the various forms of the 1960s and 1970s countercultural discourse, and now thoroughly integrated into a commodity of neoliberal capitalism, that authentic life is a necessary ethical and practical safeguard of the self in opposition to the dangers of accelerated capitalism. It is though not coincidental that Kennedy's The Cuisine of Mexico was published in the very years of the transition between the global 60s and the early forays of neoliberalism. Kennedy's work emerges at a time when critics and scholars decry the staged authenticity, as Dean McCannell famously put it in his influential 1976 book, The Tourist, of post-industrial travel experiences. The gradual massification of air travel, the lowering cost of global circulation, and the growing demand of experiences of global South authenticity as a response to the alienating effects of the post-industrial economy in the global North opened the space for people like Kennedy's notion of experience to become a stand-in for Mexican authentic food at large. And I'm not going to talk about this, but Kennedy's books are translated into Spanish, and they're massive bestsellers, and Mexicans learn to cook reading Diana Kennedy, so it's not just for the English-speaking world. I challenge you to cook a recipe from Diana Kennedy's book. It's quite difficult. Kennedy's main enemy is the mixed plate, the omnipresent dish that combines staples like enchiladas or fajitas with rice and beans. She refers to the dish in unquestionably derisive terms. Far too many people know Mexican food as a mixed plate, a crisp taco filled, you can imagine, British accent, right? Filled with ground meat, heavily flavored with an all-purpose chili powder, a soggy tamal covered with a sauce that turns up on everything, too sweet and too overpoweringly onion, a few fried beans, and something else that looks and tastes like all the rest. One must not overlook, however, that the attack on purportedly inauthentic Mexican-American food, embodied in her disdain for the combo plate, dismisses the complexity of the immigrant restaurateur experience, including the need to accommodate the taste of uneducated patrons as well as the effect of culinary racism, which imposes on many U.S. ethnic restaurants the imperative to be inexpensive and to stick to a narrow repertoire of recipes. So if you know about the ethics of eating in restaurants, one thing that you should never expect from an immigrant restaurant is for it to be cheap. Because if you are willing to pay $35 for a plate of pasta in Italy, which is just pasta and a can and like a jar of sauce, and you don't pay for a curry or a mole that are very complex and hard labor dishes, you are being discriminatory. So that's what the term culinary racism refers to. Yet Kennedy's narrative cannot solely be read as a rejection of Mexican-American food. In fact, her way of thinking of food is directly related to both the Heideggerian existentialist idea of the return to origins as a way to protect the self and the countercultural idea of removing oneself from the alienating experiences of the modern. In many instances of self-fashioning that precede her various cookbooks, we can see a rehearsal of the different repertoires of discourse of authenticity related to self. In The Cuisines of Mexico, Kennedy narrates her life as a quest to taste authentic foods, in a journey that begins in her experience in the Women's Timber Corps in Wales during World War II. As she strolled through small rural towns, she recalls with great sensorial details foods such as the wedges of homemade bread spread thickly with freshly churned butter, and salmon trout dished from the river that ran within a few yards of the cottage. As Kennedy began to travel, she became defined by the perception of authentic fruits from Europe, like rice cooked with minute crabs that had to be soaked noisily to extract their sweet juice, to North America. I had never eaten such crusty rye bread as that of the Spadina Market in Toronto. To the Caribbean, I ate my first mango, a huge Bombay, conveniently standing up to my neck in crystal clear water on a small island in the Kingston Harbor. All of these sensorial experiences galvanized in cooking, which she claims she learned to reproduce what had been eaten with such pleasure. As she moves to Mexico, her experience, mediated by the cooking of her local mates and friends, was read in from the framework of authenticity and pleasure created in her previous travels, and ultimately, Kennedy began a cooking school for Mexican food in Mexico in 1969. That's still running, actually. The point of these assertions is that Kennedy's notion of authenticity is philosophically grounded, that's not there yet, is philosophically grounded not so much in the culinary nationalism that Mexicans were promoting at the same time, and there's a whole strain of people valuing Mexican food in the 60s and getting away from liking just French and Spanish food, but that's a different talk. But rather in a sort of British idea of the rural as a site of authenticity. As Raymond Williams shows in his landmark book, The Country and the City, the idea of the countryside was still present even in this exceptional industrialized and urbanized nation and demonstrated that the distinction of country and city was an essential division of labor that had to be overcome in order to fully engage capitalism. Kennedy moves in the opposite direction, asserting the authenticity of rural labor over urban industrialization and thinking her work as a way to preserve the former from the threat of the latter. It is nonetheless telling that The Cuisines of Mexico and The Country and the City were written simultaneously. Kennedy's reading of Mexico was implicitly informed by the very sense of industrial decay and idealization of the countryside that Raymond Williams describes. This is the reason why her frames of reference are not the same as the ones promoted by the Mexican state or by Mexican intellectuals. While Salvador Novo highlights in his 1967 Cocina Mexicana, which is the one that I wrote the other article about, the urban nature of Mexican cuisine by highlighting high-end restaurants and experiences, places like La Fonda de Santa Anita, which sought to bring tradition to the urban scene, The Cuisines of Mexico privilege rural forms of the cuisine traced in particular to Kennedy's Oaxacan maid. And the maid is not a joke, it's true. Like, she narrates how she learned how to taste like real Mexican food because her maid was cooking it for her from Oaxaca. And then what her method, and I will describe this in a moment, is she doesn't claim authorship of the recipes, but she goes and does interviews with women of all social strata in different regions, and she credits in her cookbooks the recipes to the women who provided the recipes to her. Whether the women get royalties or not, that's a different and more uncomfortable question, but I'm not going to get to that one here. Kennedy's question of authenticity proceeds as her cookbooks develop through her growing penchant for regionalization. The Cuisines of Mexico recognizes the idea of distinct Mexican gastronomies only sparingly, and is based basically by the authentic versus inauthentic Mexican versus Mexican-American binaries. While her 1975 work, The Tortilla Book, clearly she seeks to make her food accessible for the non-Mexican home cook. So The Cuisines of Mexico requires a lot of skill to cook with. The Tortilla Book doesn't. And yet her 1978 book, Recipes from the Regional Cooks of Mexico, which now, if you want to buy it now, it's called Mexican Regional Cooking, begins a trend that would highlight rural regions of Mexico and the indigenous and peasant women cooks living in them as the source repository of culinary knowledge. Regionalism is presented as a further step in authenticity, as Kennedy informs us that her Mexican friends, who chided her for not including their favorite and obscure region recipes in the cuisines of Mexico, had to include them. The book registers the different sourcing of ingredients and recipes, but it's significantly not organized by dish by region, but by dish type. So you will have soups and then soup from Nayarit, soup from Yucatan, soup from Puebla, right? Indeed, each individual recipe has a regional origin, but it would be quite difficult for a user of the book to craft a regionally informed full meal from it. In any case, Kennedy articulates in her introduction the fact that her further movement towards tradition, rural areas and regions is informed by her quest to resist modernization. And this is the quote. Things in Mexico are changing and changing fast, too fast for the majority of people to fully comprehend, and thus concern what is good and reject what is bad. Right? So this is the British person telling us how to modernize, basically, right? Too much is being lost through the wild demographic explosion the country is experiencing. I should like to think of my books as contributing towards the recording and preservation of an important aspect of Mexican life and culture. And that's a safe assertion, because actually it has had that effect. That there's a lot of stuff that is lost but is registered by Diana Kennedy and sometimes no one else. So, you know, it's a very complicated thing, because in U.S. ethnic politics, when I use the term appropriation, right, which claims the idea that someone from a more hegemonic racial or class standpoint cannot use the culture of the marginalized. But if you look at cases like this, that's a very problematic assertion. I don't think that genetics is the thing that gives you authority. It's knowledge that gives you authority. And it is true that Diana Kennedy saved a lot of traditions when Mexicans really didn't care about at the time. She knows more than any Mexican about Mexican food. So, and I think that validates her, because she's not someone that is just trying to open like a superfluous restaurant in New York. She's someone that actually dedicated her life to registering an encyclopedic form of knowledge that the people who create that knowledge didn't even think that it was knowledge, basically. So, right. Okay. Regionalism in Kennedy is thus tied to the effects of Mexican modernization in the 1970s, which included an outsized growth of urban areas, transnationalization, growing destruction of natural resources, and the like. The writing of recipes from different areas in Mexico and the crediting of many of these recipes to women brought from the lower class, maids and peasants, and the middle class, mostly housewives with family cookbooks, is part of the structure of legitimacy of this narrative. It is indeed telling that Kennedy openly states that her goal as a book author is to find the wisdom of the past that can guide us to the future. That's her words. Authentic Mexican foods in her telling, from fidelity to past techniques, and traditional ingredients. She, for instance, insists that ingredients should not be changed unless substitutions are suggested, and calls for her readers to, quote, mail order or ask friends in Texas and California to send you care packages. Or you can get together with other aficionados and cajole or bully your local supermarket manager into being more imaginative about the product section. I should do that in St. Louis, where I can find a pasote, for example. In the 2008 edition of her 1989 book, The Art of Mexican Cooking, and one can recognize the word art as a crucial signifier, she goes as far as to reject globalization itself. There is another gastronomic loss in Mexico that portends a dismal future if allowed to continue. The importation of chiles from China, identified as somewhat similar to guajillos. And you know, chiles from China and from Asia are the same variety than chiles from Mexico, because they came with the galleon of Manila during colonial times. It's just that they, over history, grew different because of changes of condition, but it's the same species. So, you know, there's some of this purism. And, you know, I've had the guajillos from China and the guajillos from Mexico, and you cannot really tell the difference. I don't know if she can, but I can't. Although her reasons for decrying this phenomenon are indeed noble, like the support of local farmers and the preservation of biodiversity, it is also true that there is a strain of fundamentalism in her understanding what is properly Mexican and regional. The effect of Kennedy's notion of authenticity should be carefully valued and not simply dismissed here as an excessive form of traditionalism. To be sure, Kennedy is very well respected in Mexico, and her works have been essential to the rebirth of Mexican food in Mexico from the 1980s onward. As Diana Kennedy consolidated her status as the key representative of Mexican food in English language publishing, Rick Bayless began emerging as a crucial figure in reframing the idea of authenticity of Mexican food. While Diana Kennedy claims to authenticity operate, as mentioned before, in relation to a European nostalgia of the rural as a site to resist the modern, Bayless's idea of authenticity is fully grounded in a set of cultural practices related to neoliberal appropriations of traditional cultures. He began his career giving cooking classes after graduating from the University of Oklahoma, which led to hosting a PBS series called Cooking Mexican in the late 70s. I have not been able to find this series, so if someone knows of a copy, please burn it and send it to me. Although the series is now inaccessible, Bayless has noted that the show was the result of both his work in food research and his own classes. Bayless did not work on the amateur narrative like Kennedy, a food enthusiast who has never actually claimed the title of being a chef. Bayless openly claims that his academic education, and the academic education is interesting because he had a major in Spanish and Latin American studies, and then he got a PhD in anthropological linguistics, and now he's a multimillionaire. So, provided he did, so this major and minor and the PhD, according to him, provided him with tools to methodically collect the information of his cuisine, right? So he goes as an anthropological linguist to interview people about cooking. That's what he did in Mexico in the 80s. The version of Bayless that is currently a household name was launched by his... By the way, Rick Bayless, if you like sports, he's the brother of Skip Bayless from ESPN. Yeah. The version of Bayless that is currently a household name was launched by his 1987 cookbook, Authentic Mexican, co-authored by his partner and wife, Dean Grom Bayless. Authentic Mexican departs from a cultural script similar to the one set forward by Kennedy. The book is subtitled Regional Cooking from the Heart of Mexico, which emphasizes both the regional narrative that Kennedy had canonized with the idea that there is a heart of Mexico located in the center as opposed to the border. Right? So part of the struggle here is northern Mexican food represents Mexican food in the U.S., and Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless are bringing it to Oaxaca, to Puebla, right? We have a Pueblan here, so she probably agrees. I'm a Chilango, I think we're the center of Mexico, so. But you know, of course, the point of that aside comment is that regionalism is a side of struggle, right? Who represents a country? Of course, calling the idea of the heart in Rick Bayless clearly echoes the very familiar U.S. concept of the heartland, which locates the center of the country, again, in the authenticity of the national experience in rural, white, conservative areas. This parallel could not go possibly unnoticed to a man from Oklahoma, of all places, whose family actually had a business in one of those heartland traditions, barbecue. Unlike Kennedy, who sees herself as a preserver of Mexican food from the winds of modernity, Bayless's images are not of rural areas, but of the modern, locating his learning experience in markets, restaurants, and street stalls, as well as the growing number of dressy restaurants from the time. In other words, Bayless presents Mexico as a modern country and cuisine whose tradition is generally tied to urban spaces. His mapping of Mexico City not only includes historical restaurants, but also urban coffee shops and the admission that Mexican food is as much consumed with traditional beverages as it is with Coca-Cola and beer. Although Authentic Mexican does not have the creative licenses of his later cookbooks, and there are a lot of licenses in the later ones, it is clear that Bayless does not equate authenticity with tradition, but rather with the idea of lived practice that evidently derives from his scholarly training in anthropological linguistics, which is based not on normative notions of languages, but on the study of language as a living entity. This is precisely the key of Bayless's reframing of Mexican cuisine. His interest is not so much the normative notion of authenticity that rejects any variation from the mixed plate to the nouvelle cuisine approaches, as preached by Kennedy, but rather an understanding of Mexican food as a living practice. This is a key factor because in Rick Bayless, the notion of authentic Mexican food refers not to orthodox recreation of tradition, but the reenactment of the lived experience of eating in Mexico, even if the actual food is different. Authentic Mexican, as well as Bayless's flagship restaurant, Frontera Grill, which opened in 1987, is the product of a significant realignment of U.S. food culture. In Josie Johnston's and Sean Bauman's telling, from the 1960s onward, there was an increasing interest in ethnic foods The development of food as part of an emerging idea of lifestyle. This is when they opened Dean and DeLuca and Whole Foods, for example. And the advent of review systems like the Sagat Guide and Gourmet Culture. Vélez has no need to negotiate with either Mexican culinary nationalism or with a nostalgic notion of tradition, as his cookbooks were part of an ecosystem in which he could really redefine Mexican food in very concrete terms. Vélez takes part instead of a significant historical transformation of food as a cultural and social practice in the United States that goes from countercultural appeals to tradition and liberation in the 1960s to full-fledged neoliberal systems of consumption in which authentic Mexican is in constant interaction with the eating publics of urban sites who seek to consume ethnic foods as a matter of distinction. Right? It's more or less the same parallel to the organic food movement. So it has a narrative of authenticity, of virtue, of value, and it's also really freaking expensive. And it's really only for the bourgeoisie that is moving back at this time from the suburbs to the urban cores. This is the reason why Vélez's success in the restaurant industry is more relevant in the redefinition of Mexican food as hot cuisine in the United States. And this is one thing that he really needs to be credited for. A lot of people think that Mexican food should be tacos and should be cheap. A lot of Mexican culinary traditions, tacos are not central to the tradition. If you go to the Yucatan, tacos are not central in that tradition. Rick Bailey, for you to be able to have that kind of Mexican cooking, you have to spend money. Rick Bailey is the first person that successfully brings non-Mexicans to expensive Mexican restaurant, and it does open the door for Enrique Olvera to open Cosmo in Los Angeles, you know, or for Hugo Ortega to open his restaurants in Houston. Because thanks to Rick Bayless, Mexicans then can later come in and sell expensive food. I just went to this place in Orange County called Taco Maria that is exceptional, that Rick Bayless has visited many times, and it's $120 prefix for tacos. Worth every penny. See? But the notion that a taco cannot be expensive is what a bowl of pasta can. I don't like pasta, so I think it's a waste of calories, but it's a very problematic assertion, right? Or for those of us who think that French food is butter upon butter with no spice contrast, and I would much rather eat a curry if I'm gonna eat butter than eat French food, but the way in which we distinguish global, northern, global south cuisines in terms of prestige. It has been very problematic, and people like Rebellis have been the ones cutting through that in the US market. This is the reason why Bayless's success in the restaurant industry is more relevant. What he ultimately delivered was a neoliberal synergetic enterprise that is able to cater to middle and upper class consumers the experience of distinctive authenticity that the old immigrant businesses, mostly run by working class Mexicans recreating street food, were not. Vélez does not sell fashion like a long-term seeker of the lost authentic, but rather as a translator who constantly interacts with living Mexican culture and seeks to render it into a living American culture. He, in fact, directly translates some of his guests in his show rather than relying on his interpreter. So I don't know if you have seen his show. You can watch it in Vimeo if you don't watch it in PBS. But basically, he has a half of the show in a Mexican location, like a restaurant or something, interviewing or eating something. And then he tries to recreate in the kitchen, but obviously doing a different thing. Like he uses things like that Mexicans don't have in their house, like grills, right? Crockpots. I didn't even know what a crockpot was until I moved here. But you can make a very good cochinita pibil in a crockpot, actually. Of course, what I don't have in San Luis is a oven in my backyard, so. So he defines himself as a translator in his 1996 book, Rick Bayless's Mexican Kitchen. In essence, I see my role of that as that of a translator. Frequently, the translation is easy. Ingredients, techniques, and ways of serving are equivalent here and in Mexico, of course, because both high cuisine traditions derive from French. Other times I have to translate the delicious integrity of authentic Mexican cooking into a vernacular my compatriots can understand. This notion of translation has various political and ideological undertones. Citing this same passage, for example, Julie Locker places Vélez in trends related to globalization and the elevation of so-called ethnic cuisines in the first world due to an economic security that removes a stigma from foods identified with poverty and peasantry. And that has another history. You know that the French cuisine had a lot of spices. That's why they opened the routes to Asia. But they stopped because they used to get sick when they went to colonize Africa to their stomachs, and they thought it was the spices, and it was actually the bacteria, but they didn't know this. And the other thing is that there was a Catholic movement that thought that spices were too sexual. And that you got aroused by spices, and then they promoted temperance, and that you should eat like butter and milk because that's like not sexy, you know? Whether butter is sexy or not is another conversation. So it removes the stigmas from food identified with poverty and peasantry. The growing concern for preserving local cultures under the threat of global homogenization and the heterogeneity of social experiences generated by globalization itself. You know, globalization is very curious, right? Because it homogenizes and heterogenizes at the same time. But for my purposes, a more relevant point in Bailey's self-fashioning is that he puts the very notion of Mexican gastronomical authenticity under contention, particularly challenging the type of authenticity claimed by Kennedy, although he doesn't mention her directly. He argues that purely ethnographic collections of recipes often leave me frustrated in the kitchen, wondering how to use ingredients from my market and equipment in my kitchen to achieve the wonderful flavors I am reading about. Like Diana King will tell you, you don't cook with barro, you shouldn't cook, right? So Bayless is writing against that. To my way of thinking, if authentic cooking is truly going to mean something to us, we have to actually get the great flavors to the table. This statement stands in stark contrast with Kennedy's recommendations about getting a care package cited above. Bayless thusly answers his own questions: are the recipes of this book authentic? Can a gringo guy with popular stateside restaurants flesh out the nuances of Mexico's real cooking? By arguing, if you agree to me that authentic cooking respectfully utilizes traditional ingredients and time-honored techniques to prepare dishes that express the spirit of a particular people, then yes, this is authentic cooking at its best. But if your vision of the authentic is only a recipe as artifact spelled out in ethnographic detail, then what I do is a step further. The self as real is one of the terms that I discussed with Heidegger, so but I'm going to use it anyways. The self as real that Bayless implies does not base itself as the self as authentic located in the past, but rather as an authenticity that is only so insofar as it exists in living experience, and that has a project of futurity, namely the possibility of creating new dishes to express the spirit of a particular people. This displacement is crucial because it allows Bayless to not be restricted to the role of preserver as defined by Kennedy, but rather to become an enunciator of Mexican tradition himself. So there is nothing in Diana Kennedy that says, I created a recipe of Mexico, a Mexican dish. Rick Bayless creates recipes of Mexican dishes. That's the leap in here. Bayless's current revision foray, his cookbooks, show this evolution in a compelling way. A typical episode of Mexico One Plate at the Time is narrated by counterpointing a segment where Bayless is eating a local food or interacting with a local chef or figure, and a scene in his home kitchen in Chicago. And in the new season, he bought an apartment in Mexico City, so that's an interesting, where he recreates part of the experience at home. If one follows Bayless's full activities, one will also notice that this is complemented in his restaurants. The opening of Leña Brava, that's the one on the right, he's making pescado zarandeado in there, follow the time he spent shooting a television season in Baja California, while Topolobampo's seasonal menus feature a regional experience coming from his travels. Indeed, a notable aspect of his menus and recipes is the way in which they appropriate the name of traditional Mexican dishes and present them in a variation that, without departing too much from the original, negotiates not only with the availability of equipment and ingredients, but also with neoliberal foodie cultures of local and organic production. In a 2017 menu of Topolobampo, and I actually ate this, and it was very good. For instance, Bayless constructs a Mexican-inspired set of dishes with local Chicago ingredients and some wings at Mexican food. There is, for example, that's the dish, lamb mole negro and creamy white corn that features a lamb leg from a local farm. And it's not very common to find lamb in mole in Mexico. Lamb is more in barbacoa. A mole negro made from locally grown chilcuale chiles. One of the things that Rick Bayless is known for is that he's a pioneer in urban agriculture, and he has a garden in his house that grows a lot of Mexican herbs, and he has been one of the first ones to grow some of those herbs in the United States. Another foods that he recently introduced to his repertoire, such as roasted roots. And you know, dill or white corn is important because I don't know if you know the difference between corn on the cob in Mexico and the U.S., but in Mexico they harvest it earlier, so it's not sweet. Once it grows in the vine, it becomes sweeter, and that's the one they harvest in the U.S. to make corn syrup. Native Americans harvest it earlier, so that's why if you buy Iroquois white corn, it tastes closer to the Mexican corn than if you buy the one in Whole Foods or whatever. Indeed, both Mexican Every Day and More Mexican Every Day, as well as his television show, made heavy use of the home grill, the crock pot, and the rice cooker to recreate Mexican techniques such as the ground oven and to replace gadgets like the pressure cooker, more common in Mexican than U.S. households. Yet the definition of authenticity has evolved considerably, and in his unusual 2012 book, cookbook Frontera, a small book solely devoted to drinks and snacks, he admits that striving for out-of-context authenticity was like chasing a shadow and a distant memory. In response to diners that had no frame of reference and restaurants that offer museum-quality renderings of dishes from Mexico without the ingredients to create them. Rather, Bayless is stating his recent work that the one thing I could strive for is deliciousness, and that he could adapt the recipes to the seasonal availabilities in farmer markets and other venues. And this is the conclusion. This is not to say that Bayless does not police authenticity. In Mexico, One Plate at a Time, the cookbook that accompanies the 26-episode first season of the show, Bayless complains that Mexican food is still in what he calls the spaghetti at meatball stage, and regrets the fact that Mexican-American dishes like fajitas, burritos, nachos, taco salads, and the like are nowhere to be found in his book, probably because they would represent the equivalent simplicity of the Italian example, the type of ubiquitous food that is too simple to do justice to the complexity of authentic food. Having said this, a fair assessment of Bayless shows us that, as much as he may traffic the idea of authenticity in his business empire, he has provided a complementary function to that of Kennedy. Kennedy has been essential in the appreciation of Mexican food in Mexico and to the understanding of the complexity of Mexican food in the face of the U.S. market's penchant for simplification. Bayless makes complexity accessible rather than esoteric, and his focus on cultural practice turns that food into a meaningful everyday experience in the contemporary landscape. This ethical perspective traverses many of his cookbooks. In Fiesta at Rick's, he sacrifices, by his own admissions, the ideas of Mexican everyday to assert the experience of the fiesta, which he reconstructs not from a stereotypical notion, but rather from the way in which celebrating is conceived in Arroyo, a legendary restaurant in Mexico City with traditional barbacoa, various musical bands, a popular market, and a bullfighting, a place that you should go to if you haven't been in Mexico in it yet, located in the southern part of Mexico City and frequented not by tourists, but by families. He has been an essential force in diversifying the biodiversity of ingredients in the Chicago area and in supporting local Mexican grocers. Even if Diana, and that's another interesting factor, the growth of the consumption of this upper-level Mexican food really benefits Mexican peasants because they have been able to resist Monsanto corn since they have a viable market in Mexico with people like Enrique Olvera. And Rick Bayless, if you buy the Frontera Heirloom collection of chips, they come from Oaxacan heirloom corn. It's a thing. But if you buy those, he actually buys from the Oaxacan farming communities that are fighting Monsanto in Mexico. And there's a huge legal fight for Monsanto corn in Mexico right now. So, you know, it's not the ideal way to fight Monsanto, making some rich in Chicago, but it's a way to fight Monsanto, right? And I say this living in St. Louis, where Monsanto is actually located. So, the Monsanto Professor of Environmental Ethics. And this is really one of the directions in which Bayless and Kennedy are going to biodiversity, right? Like if you create a market for heirloom agricultural products, it allows the farmers to resist the push of corporate agribusiness. If you want to read about the one of the worst effects of NAFTA is in food, and there's two really great books. One is called Eating NAFTA, and the other one is called Neoliberal Diet. And these two books talk about how the agribusinesses negotiated all the agricultural chapter in NAFTA and how Mexico became the second most obese country in the world following the U.S. as a result of this, and how devastating it has been to, for example, tortillas, that you cannot really find tortillas that are not Maseca anymore, even in Mexico, unless you are rich and you go buy them from Enrique Olvera. So even if Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless will never share the defects of the generational perspectives they embody in Mexican food, the countercultural penchant for orthodox authenticity, the neoliberal understanding of authenticity as a commodity, and even if they will always face critics for not being Mexican themselves, which I think is a stupid criticism, honestly, it is clear that their performance of the category of authenticity is a central part of Mexican culinary history, and an example of the ways in which food and food cultural studies by extension is located in the crossroads between experience, modernity, ideology, and cultural practice. Thank you.
Who has questions, comments?
I don't know if I missed this, but did Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless ever work together or consider themselves contemporaries of one another?
I haven't found evidence for it. It's entirely possible that they have. Diana Kennedy lives very deep in Mexico, so she's not in the same circle of chefs that Rick Bayless goes. Bayless is very critical of her implicitly, but he doesn't say it openly, so that may be a sign that he has worked with her in some capacity. The thing is that the kind of thing that Rick Bayless does, Diana Kennedy would most definitely not approve of. So it might be that Rick Bayless might be saving himself from the tension, but I haven't found any direct reference that says that they may have collaborated. But obviously the first book of Rick Bayless is a sequel to Diana Kennedy's 78 book. Oh, thank you so much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Ignacio Sanchez Prado, Jarvis Thurston, and Mona Van Duyn, professor in the humanities at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Sanchez Prado's lecture was titled Manufacturing Authenticity, the Idea of Mexican Food in Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless, and was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies. Tonight's moderator was Adela Pineda Franco, Director of Latin American Studies at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.